Ultra Running Magazine, and not fun to look at, it's fun to learn from. And in this podcast with Tim Tollefson, one of his simple rules that we discover at the end is about hips. It's all in the hips.
Coincidentally, in the May-June issue of Ultra Running Magazine, Joe Juhan has an article in there called Hip Drive.
Yeah, because it's all in the hips.
You know, one of the other things that I noticed that Ultra Running Magazine has is they have some paraphernalia you can get on there and get some stuff, and they have a shirt.
What kind of stuff are you talking about?
They have a shirt that says Embrace the Pain Cave. Isn't that a cool shirt?
Yeah, yeah.
You got to have a t-shirt.
Let me see a picture of that, Scott. Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I would wear that.
Yeah, it's a cool t-shirt. So, but more importantly, you got to get a subscription. I mean, that's the only way that you're going to learn from all of these really cool
athletes
and
scientists
writers.
And all of stuff.
Yeah, it's great. I learn something every issue.
So simply go over to trailrunnernation.com, go to the partners page, and bam, link right over to Ultra Running Magazine and get yourself educated. Harry's Razors.
Harry's.com. You can find all of that good stuff that we've been talking about for months and months and months at Harry's.com. You get a $5 off your first purchase at Harry's.com if you use the code TRN.
There's no better deal than the Truman set, Scott. I mean, really, for $10 delivered to your doorstep, you get the best blades, three of them, a handle, some gel. You're not even helping me out here, pal. There is a little gap between each of my words, so you can just kind of submit just a little bit.
I'm just waiting. I'm just waiting for you.
I'm like my hands out, reaching out, and you're just watching me gulp for air. And so it's just the best shaving stuff available.
It is. And one of the things, that it's a great value, but the best part about Harry's that I love are those blades.
Well, Scott,
I don't cut myself anymore, and it gives me a close shave. I mean, isn't that why you buy a razor, to get a close shave?
You know what I like best about it, Scott?
What's that?
Is the case that goes around the blade. Of course you love the blades the best. That's why it's a Harry's.
That's why you buy a shaver, is so that you can get a close shave without cutting yourself.
Every time. Go to harrys.com, get yourself the Truman set, which is a standard $10 right to the doorstep. Fantastic. Treat yourself.
The only way you can get it for $10 is entering that code TRN at checkout.
I was at a race on Saturday, and Team Solomon was out there. At least the reps were out there. And you know what they asked me for?
A PEK.
A stack of PEKs.
They love those things,
yeah,
don't they?
Because they work.
You know why? Because they sell shoes. If somebody puts a PEK on and then goes runs in the Solomon shoes, they're like they're floating.
I actually think that the research and development team were secretly asking for the PEK because they're trying to go to the next level.
The Performance Enhancing Kokopelli, acronymed PEK, is crucial if you're going to have a good race.
Absolutely. If you're going to have a good anything, Scott, we've put the image on the cell phone, and you can do that for free but just by grabbing an image. Better battery life.
It does.
You've got one on your truck.
So if you go to our webpage, trailrunnernation.com, go to the store and get yourself a bundle of the Performance Enhancing Kokopelli temporary tattoos and share them with your trail friends.
Get ready for the run of your life.
Ladies and gentlemen of the worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
Yeah. I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Warr.
And I'm Don Freeman, and we are gathered here to have a little fun, Scott.
I think we are. Who do we have today, Don?
We have Nike trail athlete Tim Tollefson, and, you know, we've been trying to get him for a while, but he's so darn fast that we had to wait for an out and back so we could we could actually get his attention. You have certainly, if you've watched any of the ongoings of what's happening in ultra running, you've seen Tim as the 2014 U.S. 50K trail champion. He is a physical therapist and an exercise physiologist, and I want to ask you about that in a second, Tim. And most recently, UTMB CCC second place finisher at his first time at the 100K distance, and there's quite a story on that, and YouTube links and all kinds of things that we'll post to this that really show the amazing event that is and the tremendous accomplishment. So welcome, Tim Tollefson, Nike athlete, to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. You know, just at the beginning, before we hit record, we just found out that we were near neighbors there when you were in high school at the Rockland High School and on the track team, and it was kind of fun to bounce back and forth with some locations that we both recognize.
I know, indeed. Yeah, you're in my old stomping grounds. Did plenty of runs up and down Sunset Boulevard and through old Rockland, Springview Park, all those great places. And as we mentioned earlier, or off the air, Mongolian Barbecue had our pasta feeds or noodle feeds the night before 5K cross-country races in high school.
hey, Tim, I know that a lot of cross-country teams now during the summer will go up to Auburn and run some of the trails or some of the trails around Lake Folsom. Did you ever get out on the trails when you were in high school?
You know, I never went up into Auburn too much or Tahoe, never went there, but we definitely went out to Cabot a lot and ran the western north end of Folsom Lake along the lower horse trail. So we did that frequently during the summer. And for us, we come from a very low mileage program. I think I peaked at maybe 35 miles a week in high school. Mm. And so our long runs were, you know, walking 7 or 8 miles out there on the trails. And we thought those were long days on the trail.
Hey, but before we get into some of the fun stuff, not that this won't be fun, but exercise physiologists, tell us a little bit about what qualifies someone or what the specialty is for an exercise physiologist.
So I guess I did my undergraduate studies at Chico State, where I studied exercise physiology, and it's basically just, the study of, exercise and the science and principles behind why things are done in such a way. And a big part of kind of how I use it now is for testing and prescription. So I help run our performance lab here at Mammoth Lakes at the hospital, and that primarily consists of doing VO2 max tests or lactate threshold tests or some running gait analysis or bike fits on people. Could be anyone interested or athletes that come through town. So that's primarily where I'm utilizing, that schooling is performing these different performance tests that we can then use to prescribe, a training program for someone, or if someone's just interested in the data pre and post, a training block, or to see how they fare at altitude, because our lab here is at about 7,835 feet, which is quite a bit higher than, say, Rockland or Sacramento. But so that's kind of that little subset of kind of my professional life is where I use that background.
I mean, what a great thing. You have your own lab that you can check out VO2 max and watch your training and go longer, harder, and check and see where you're at. Do you utilize that to help influence your training throughout the year and your training blocks?
You know, to be honest, personally, I don't. Part of it is that I can't test myself. And I do have another coworker that at some point we are going to test me, but she's been kind of in and out of the office, traveling with various groups. And so it's been hard to kind of pinpoint a time that actually worked, but I do with the local track club, like the Mammoth Track Club. Names like Dina Castor might ring a bell and some of the other Olympians. But so we use it with them where I've tested her and her teammates. And then, we might do a pre and post season test to see if there were any variable changes or if their coach is just interested in the data. So we definitely use that. And the VO2 max test isn't as critical, but something like the lactate threshold test helps set training parameters much, we can dial in the specific workouts to a greater extent using that kind of information. So it is something that a lot of people I work with use a lot. Personally, I don't. I'm kind of old school, where at Chico from Garytown, I kind of learned just to listen to internal cues from my body. I've never worn a heart rate monitor when training. I kind of like the, I mean, everything I do is based in science, but I'm not actually using anything other than just quantitative splits on my watch for specific workouts. But
You know, you may have answered my question, but the question I was going to ask is, when you get people in, runners in that are experienced runners, and you do a lactate threshold test, do you find that they're surprised at where their lactate threshold is? They assume by feel that, you know, it's 130 and it's actually 110 or something like that?
Yeah. You know, I do. And that's where I think that information is very important, or it can be useful, is we all have sort of, you know, these visions of what we feel are appropriate paces. And oftentimes that's based on people we run with or things we've read, and it may not really suit us as an individual. So if you can objectively give someone that information and say, hey, you know, what you thought you were doing is actually, it supersedes your lactate threshold, you know, maybe you're training too hard. Yeah, I think that's very helpful. And we do find a lot of athletes train harder on a daily basis or in workouts than they probably should. And that could explain some, you know, other parameters, why they're not improving, or if they're hitting, you know, plateaus, or they're overtrained, stuff like that. I think it's helpful with.
Have you looked in and tested some super elite athletes or just super achievers and found their numbers, and then scratch your head and you say, how in the heck are these numbers supporting that kind of performance?
No one comes to mind off the top of my head. I've had a couple, so I guess you're saying like a low VO2, but still incredible performances.
Because we've always heard that you really can't just put them in a lab and then separate everybody on their finish time just based, because there's so many variables, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I could test, let's say I got in a, you know, an incredible trail runner, you know, marathon runner, and his VO2 max was 60, you know, solid, but it doesn't hit a lot of people's kind of threshold of maybe 68 to 72 is where they call elite. Mm-hmm. But if we think about those events, not often throughout the event are you going to be running at your VO2 max. So something more like a lactate threshold is going to be more indicative of performance than a VO2 max. The VO2 max is kind of like that glory number everyone, or people may brag about it or talk about, man, Killian's VO2 max is off the charts. And that could be true, but it doesn't necessarily mean that Killian's not a good example, but someone else with a high VO2 max isn't necessarily going to perform better if they're not trained or if they have other variables that are lacking. So I can't think of anyone off the top of my head, but I definitely think, you know, that is a possibility.
Yeah, and I didn't want you to mention any names. I just conceptually, you know, because there's
we have a HIPAA violation that may pop in.
Oh yeah, you're playing the HIPAA card. All right.
Yeah, Scott, I can pull that card.
Sure, you can.
Hey Tim, Nike trail running team is very fortunate to have you part of that team. Do they dip into your knowledge and resources a little bit to say, hey, We need our team to improve, or we'd like to see how they can improve? Tim, how can we do that?
No, they don't. It's something that I wish they would. I've mentioned it to people, but there didn't seem to be any interest, or maybe it was passed along to the wrong individuals, or it got lost in the mix. But because I feel like some of the insight that, or not even insight, but the tools that I have access to and some of this could be very beneficial. And I love kind of sharing this knowledge or testing people and doing that type of stuff. So I feel like it's sort of an untapped market, and I'd love to do it in the future. But I guess it just needs the right environment to really thrive in. So unfortunately, it hasn't happened yet.
So if someone is lives around Northern California, Pacific Northwest, or Switzerland, and happens to be coming through Mammoth Lakes, and they think, hey, I want to go visit Tim. I listen to this podcast, and Tim does this stuff. Is that something they can call somewhere and set up an appointment? And how does that all work?
Yeah, they could just call the Mammoth Sports Center, which is part of Mammoth Hospital, and just request an appointment with me, and then we could definitely test them. We have people that do that. People that, you know, or coming in just for a week, or a training stint over the summer is not uncommon. I have triathletes or a lot of cyclists that come through that are interested in that data, because typically they are individuals that really are kind of data junkies. But it's all you have to do is call the Mammoth Sports Center's front office, and then they can you know, direct you towards me, and we could set it up if anyone was interested.
Cool. And that includes some gait analysis that you mentioned earlier. And that's critical, too, just being super efficient with the energy that you have and your resources you have so you're not fighting yourself is a good tool, too. So one of the things that we were talking about as far as some of these lab numbers, there's heart that's involved in it, too. And as I read your article that's on your blog that was initially, I think, originally produced from Chico State, somebody had written from walk-on to world-class athlete. And it talks through some of your challenges and perseverance and just a lot of heart. Can you talk about being a walk-on and then moving through to being recognized on more of an elite level?
Sure. I don't think I really have a special story by any means, but my wife and I, Lindsay, we joke that we're just too stubborn to give up, and I guess that's what kind of kept us in the game this long. It has been a fun journey when I look back on it, because I picked up running in high school really to stay in shape for soccer. I played competitive soccer throughout Sacramento, and that was really my jam. I loved soccer, and running was just something to stay in shape for it. And then I finally, around sophomore, junior year of high school, realized that my ball handling skills were not quite as up to the par as maybe just my true foot speed and my endurance. So I kind of transitioned over to where my senior year at Rockland, I full on did cross country in the fall and track in the spring. And thankfully I had, coaches that believed in me and a couple ex-teammates from Rockland that were at Chico State at the time that advocated for me and told the coach Gary Town, hey, take a chance on this kid. I think he at least had the heart to stick it out, and with an opportunity, maybe he can improve. And thankfully, Gary took a chance on me as well. And over my 5 years, painfully, built myself from the 35 miles a week runner in high school to running 90 to 100 miles a week and doing workouts I never dreamed of. And through just a lot of just really pain and anguish throughout those years. But it was fun, and it's kind of neat to look back and think of, I had, high school friends that were, either runners up at the state meet and, that were recruited to schools, and I never made it to the state meet. And then even in college, I made it to the national championships 5 times, but unfortunately I fell 1 spot short of All-American honors, I think 3 times, which was a total bummer. And, every collegiate athlete, all they want is All-American status. You get that, and it's kind of like your career is complete. So when I graduated, I felt like there was a lot of unfinished business, coming up short that many times. And then that kind of motivated me to keep training after. But the post-collegiate system is a strange world. You go from having everything set up and handed to you, where you have practice 2-a-days and you have a great team and camaraderie and a coach that believes in you and, a system or a school that hopefully is supporting your academics. And then you graduate and everything's erased, and it's kind of like fumbling around trying to find a post-collegiate team maybe to train with or a coach to help you out. And you really have no focus anymore. And I think that's where a lot of athletes just kind of hang it up and stop running. And thankfully, Lindsay, my wife and I, we just like running. So we knew we were going to continue to run, but through the good fortune of some close friends and people that kind of helped guide us, we navigated that post-collegiate kind of environment and found our way into road racing, which is what a lot of people do. And then I guess I finally had some sort of breakout in 2011. I think that's when I hit my first trials qualifier in the marathon at CIM. Great race. My favorite marathon still to date. I think it's kind of just a testament of being stubborn and not wanting to quit, and actually a love for running. Through all of these ranks, in high school, obviously you don't get any sponsorships. In college, I was a walk-on, so I didn't have a full ride, or I didn't even have any assistance. And then in the post-collegiate world, there's no assistance unless you're really good until you kind of start making your way up the ranks. So you really have to have that passion just for running and training to stay in it that long. And I think that's fundamentally what Lindsay and I care about the most. So, if someone's throwing us travel money or money now, we're very thankful. But even if that, dries up, we're going to be doing this as long as our bodies hold up, just because we love the sport.
And you run with a lot of passion. The Olympic trial, the qualifying time was what, 2 hours and 18 minutes? What was your, and I'm sorry, I should probably know, I've done my homework. Your best marathon time was?
So the trials qualifier was 2:19:00, 2 hours, 19 minutes, and 0 seconds. And I ran 2:18:26 at CIM for the 2012 trials. And then for 2016, I ran 2:18:29, 3 seconds slower. Both of those were at CIM. Actually, in that second one, I was 3 seconds behind David Laney, who he had been. So we basically almost ran the exact same time at CIM, which was kind of fun. And then now we're teammates. That was before we were teammates.
Yeah, and so, Pat Warhane over there, the coach at, or at least the manager over at Nike Trail, he has somehow, and whether it's him or I'm giving him all the credit for it, has really gone out and identified some amazing athletes that were on road and brings them over towards the trail. Can you talk a bit about that? Am I off base on that, or is he a wizard?
No. Yeah, Pat's a wizard. Papa Pat. I think Pat's done a fantastic job with our team. You know, he started out with a pretty solid crew, and then myself, I contacted him first and kind of set up a conversation. But I think he's done a great job with, you know, helping to kind of foster, you know, these guys. And what a lot of us were drawn to is that our team feels much more like a cross-country team. And since we have backgrounds on the road or backgrounds in actual cross-country in high school or college, it just is a natural transition to become another group where you have that camaraderie and you have these, you know, 7 or 8 guys that you can just kind of lean on. And you have that true team atmosphere, even if we're in totally different towns and or states. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that we were drawn towards. And also, you know, coming into the trail world, a lot of outsiders may have the perspective of, you know, the Robs or the Antons, where, you know, these big burly beards and long hair and they're hippies. And we're, you know, kind of these clean cut guys. Maybe someone has a mustache here or there, but, you know, that's more the Prefontaine stash. And so it's kind of these merging worlds that, if you are so unfamiliar or kind of timid in it, this is just familiarity. It feels easy to join in. And then, you know, I think success breeds success, where you see your friends doing well and you want to do well, and that just kind of motivates you to continue progressing.
How do you say you kind of feels like a cross-country team. Do you guys go to, when you sit down with your calendars, do you guys coordinate calendars so that you're, you know, there's 2 or 3 of you at each of these key races, or is it just by chance that you're at the same races? How does that coordination all that work?
Yeah, there's not an official, schedule that we set up, but there are a couple races that we all kind of, you know, mention that, hey, this would be cool to get a group going to, and which is, you know, both a great thing, because then you show up with, you know, with your team and you feel excited just to be there and you have a fun experience. But at the same time, then it makes it tough to win race, because, you know, you're lining up with some of your kind of badass teammates and you're thinking, damn it, like, if I just gone to this other race next weekend, I could have won maybe, you know, and I finished 4th or 5th. But, you know, at the same time, it's something bigger than ourselves. We're not necessarily all out there just to win a race. I think it's about promoting, you know, the sport as a whole, and just bringing some hopefully positive attention to the sport or these events, and showing that, you know, there's life after the track or life after the roads. So I think it's something that we enjoy going to together. And it's, a couple of key ones keep popping up. You know, Way Too Cool is a fun one, because that runs like a road race for the most part. It's not technical and you have perfect conditions. Something like UTMB and CCC, that was a fun one that, you know, especially if you're going to another country, having familiarity of a teammate or an American with you is a huge benefit. And then the North Face 50 was another one. I think those have kind of been 3 big ones for all of our Nike guys and women even. But
I want to get into that, the North Face 50, 2014. That was the first time you ran it, correct?
It was, yep.
And
first time, yep.
And I read through that race report just to, you know, make sure that I knew what was happening with Tim. And your 50th mile, you ran, it says in there, at a 5:21 pace. That's fast.
It was a downhill mile.
Okay, well,
he's so humble.
Yeah, that's good. But in there,
it still means you had to have some turnover. you weren't on the ground very much during that last mile.
Well, yeah, that was kind of funny. I remember that one specifically because I'm coming down, and what's kind of spurred my or kind of relit my fire was I'd gone through, you know, some kind of down miles, and I there's a fantastic runner out of Mill Valley, Jorge Maravilla, who I'm sure you guys are familiar with. Uh-huh. And so I spotted him ahead of me, and I thought, hey, I'm going to catch him. So I just started basically kind of sprinting to try and catch him. And then he turned and saw me, and he started sprinting. I think he probably ran a 5:30 mile, like trying to run away from me. And but it was fun. And I think the reason I was able to turn it over so well is that, you know, maybe around 35 miles or like 45 or so, I was really kind of having a tough time in the mud sections of that course. And so I had kind of gotten to a phase where I was no longer running. It was more just kind of like a hike or a walk. And I think I just had a lot left in the tank as a result. But
and so that leads me to ask you the questions that kind of became part of that race report. Are the couple of lessons that you learned? Number one, 50 miles is longer than 26.2.
And, I think it is a little bit longer, yeah.
And you had some pacing lessons and some nutrition lessons. Can you talk a little bit about the differences of, you know, running, you know, twice the distance and the consideration of pace and food and fuel?
Sure. Yeah, you know, in a marathon, depending on, you know, if you're an elite level or, you know, you're running a 2-hour 10 marathon or a 2-hour 20 or, you know, middle of the pack running 3 to 4 hours, you can get away with a poor nutrition plan in a marathon. You know, you're out there for a relatively short amount of time. I mean, I've done marathons where I don't take anything and, you know, you kind of inevitably are going to kind of start to quote unquote bonk around that 18 to 22 mark possibly. You know, you can get away with a poor nutritional plan. That's not really the case in these longer distances. You know, you really have to respect the fact that you're out there for 4, 5, 10, 20 hours and the body cannot operate, you know, on its stores alone for that where you could on the marathon. And so I think, you know, and going in, I wasn't naive to thinking that, but some big things that I learned from the North Face 50 was that, you know, going in with a plan, you know, you should be open to contingencies or, you know, just know that it's not going to go according to plan, kind of prepare for that, you know, because what I thought was working in my stomach in training just wasn't working on race day. And I had to adjust on the fly. And I think that kind of threw me off a little bit because I hadn't really experienced that. And then, you know, the pacing is, it's totally different where coming from a 26 mile race, or I guess I'd done 150K before that or 250Ks, you know, just trying to allot my energy budget, you know, figuring out how are my legs going to feel after 4 hours of running? I've never done this before. You know, how am I going to feel after 6 hours of running? So it was all kind of foreign territory that I was definitely respectful of because I hadn't experienced it. And I didn't want to go in there thinking, oh, this is going to be easy. And I'm just going to, you know, run like strong to the finish. I think I learned a lot about, you know, just kind of budgeting my energy and realizing that it was okay to walk up hills because it's not okay to walk in a marathon if you're running a competitive marathon, and that if walking up the hill, you know, occurs, that doesn't mean your race is over, because that was a big mental barrier for me to overcome. You know, if I walk in a road race, I'm finished. I might as well drop out. Like, why continue on? But walking in an ultra marathon is not uncommonplace. And in a lot of ways, it's a smart strategic strategy. So I think that was a big kind of aha moment for myself.
So you mentioned that you ran 250Ks. That was like in September and October of 2014. And then between October and December, which is when the North Face 50 was, 50 miler, you had a few months to train. Did you adjust your training for the 50 miler? And how did you adjust that training?
Yeah, I did adjust it. And at this point, I was all self-coached, just kind of talking to friends and doing a lot of reading on what I thought would be appropriate. And I'd say the biggest adjustments that I did were I introduced that back-to-back long run And so I do, you know, maybe two 18 milers in a row, or a 20 and a 24 miler. And I think that was something I'd never done before. You know, in marathon training, you don't do that. You have a hard, typically because a long run, 18 to 20 miles, 22 miles, it's going to be hard intensity. And you don't follow that up with another hard intensity day. You need to recover the following day. So that was probably the biggest thing. I started including more hills also. But in hindsight, what I didn't do, and this was kind of funny, I guess I increased my total mileage and I increased my total vert, but I increased the mileage more than I increased the vert. So I actually was running maybe 120 miles a week preparing for North Face 50, which was more than I'd ever done for a road marathon. Just thinking, hey, it's 50 miles, I need to run this much. But then after I started looking at other competitors' Stravas, I realized they were running 70 to 90 miles a week with twice as much vert as myself. And that was a kind of a learning moment that, hey, the mileage isn't as important, but you need to harden your legs and kind of be able to climb late in a race or descend late in a race. And so that was a big learning, kind of aha moment for myself, in that I should have increased my vert more than I did my mileage.
You know, that's interesting, Strava, as a competitor.
Yeah.
Are, you know, opening up your training log to other competitors. What's the mindset, or what's the thought on that? The culture.
Yeah, I mean, definitely it could be seen as, hey, you're giving away your trade secrets or something like that. But
right.
I guess my big thing, and this started in college when I was the walk-on, I had a teammate, Nick. I remember a freshman year, we were both walk-ons, you know, not that great. And we had a conversation on a daily run that we just said, hey, if the only reason we're here is to push those top seven, you know, to be faster because they're scared that some walk-on's going to beat them to, you know, the punch, you know, make the national team, then so be it. Hopefully it makes our entire team better. And that was, you know, really our mentality all of our first years in college. And that's kind of how I feel with my post-collegiate training. I'm an open book. People can look at anything I do, because hopefully there's a younger guy that's more talented than I am that takes that and runs with it. And, you know, that pushes our sport as a whole. You know, if we get I'd love to see on the roads us compete better with the East Africans and the marathon at the Olympics. I'd love to see our track runners do that. I'd love to see trail runners compete with the Europeans, you know, and if that just means that you're sharing the knowledge, I'm all for it, because I know I'm not the most talented runner out there. I love it, and I'm consistent. But if someone else can take those, you know, mistakes that I've gone through, or, you know, take some of that training and put it to better use, I'm all for it.
I think that's really, really cool and selfless of you. And I think it will improve the sport. And I hope that culture continues. Because Scott and I, we're not really worried about what others are doing around us, because we're not able to compete with them out there. So we don't really check on Strava too much. So I'm going to ask you, as someone that doesn't know, how about the Europeans? Are they entering data on Strava? Can you compare, you know, American philosophy against the European training philosophy?
You can. I don't think this is widespread, but there are guys like Killian's on there, and that's because he's contracted with Strava, I believe, so I'm sure he's getting paid to do it, to post this stuff. But like the gentleman that I had a pretty good battle with at CCC last year, Nico Martin, he's on Strava, so it's kind of fun to follow him and see what he's up to. And I would say that one thing that I continue to learn is the Europeans are much more concerned about, you know, vert or technical, you know, steep terrain versus, you know, more of these traditional, you know, just tons of mileage or specific workouts. And it is going to vary depending on the race. You know, no one's going to go into, you know, Zagama or, you know, some of these races and not have some kind of specific workout built into their program as well. But I think there are some variations.
So since we're speaking about training, what are your thoughts on, you know, the 80-20 rule, the 80% where you're training at lower intensity and 20% to higher intensity? Do you have some thoughts on that, particularly with your background, educational background, and obviously your performance?
Yeah, you know, I think that I actually haven't run the exact numbers, but I think it is probably more important for any distance or endurance athlete to spend more time at a lower intensity than the higher intensity. And, you know, for a lot of reasons, just adaptation to that aerobic, adapting your aerobic system and building kind of what people call the base, and kind of just progressing and getting used to these, long, slow distance days. But I think that at the expense of not having some of that higher intensity stuff really does people a disservice. And, I think that part of that is why we see a lot of these course records dropping, or, I don't really care about course records, but we are seeing that across the board at a lot of races. And I think it's because, trail runners are adapting more of a methodical thought process in their training, where they're including maybe tempos or intervals or stuff like that, where in the past it may have just been long, slow days all the time, and it was about enduring these big days on the mountain, which I think gets you a long ways, but depending on the course profile, it's not going to get you a sub 15-hour time at Western if you aren't including some tempo work, like Rob. And so I think I think that it is very important that we do spend time at these faster intensities. And if for nothing more, it's going to make you a better runner. It's going to make you more efficient. If you've ever done a stride after a run, where you progressively go from a jog to a full out sprint across the football field, you find yourself that if you want to sprint faster, you have to maintain good mechanics. And that's something that's really important for us as runners, where everything's about conserving energy. If you're mechanically flawed with your form or technique, you're going to be wasting this energy. Energy leaks are going to be coming out all over your joints and through your muscles. Where if we're talking about conserving energy for a 15 to a 25 or 30 hour race, those little things add up. And if you can, make yourself a more efficient runner, I think that's going to make everyone stronger. If you're, just going for the sub 30 hour at Western, or your first belt buckle, 24 hour, I think it really behooves people not to be incorporating some of this kind of quicker stuff, with the caveat that, don't just go out there after this podcast and start sprinting down your street, because you can open yourself up to injury, so you have to do it methodically. And that's where, some proper guidance is helpful. But I think that, with anything, a slow progression and including some of these quicker training principles will really make everyone a better runner. And that's what our sport is. It's about running. Even if we are hiking, there are sections of running.
Yeah, I really love that term, energy leaks. Because if you're trying, like you said, to go 50 miles or whatever the distance, you can't afford any energy leaks.
No.
That's such a cool term. I haven't heard that before.
Yeah. But, that's a... I think later we're talking about simple rules, maybe.
yeah, that's right. We're doing simple rules too. Okay,
that ties into one of my simple rules, kind of.
I'm glad you reminded us of our simple rules podcast that we proposed to you. That's good. Hey, we're so organized.
Yeah,
Scott.
We're like an hour in, and we'll address it.
We forgot to do simple rules. Okay, since we have to do simple rules, then I've got a couple other real quickies before we get into that.
Yeah. I'm in no rush. We got all night.
All right. In fact, he's running right now on a treadmill. You can't even tell.
You can't even tell his heart rate's
I'm
not
so
even high.
You just can't even hear it.
He's so smooth.
Okay. No energy leaks.
So let's talk about training blocks. Do you have blocks that you train in where you just take some time off, or just, how do you manage your calendar?
Yeah, that's tough. Coming from the roads, I had very specific training blocks. I'd have two marathons a year, basically. And I would spend, 3 to 4 months really dialing in just specific marathon work before a marathon. And I was the type of athlete that I didn't need the race prior. I took a lot of confidence from my training. I'd look at a workout and I knew what it meant. And I would know that I was prepared based on those workouts. But as I entered in the ultra world, what was fascinating and kind of scary is, we're now running longer, and everyone's running 5 to 20 ultras a year. And I'm thinking, holy, how are people doing this? How is this sustainable? And I think part of it is it's not sustainable depending on how you're running these ultras. If they're just completion events, then possibly, but if you're actually racing at a high level, I think the burnout risk is really high. And, but it's been hard because I have fallen victim. Like I just said, in my marathon career, basically two marathons a year was all I did. My first year of ultra running, which I'm in my second year right now, I think I did 8 ultras in my first year, in the first 11 months. And that is not, that's not normal, or maybe it is the norm in the ultra world, but I just thought to myself objectively, you are racing way too much. I'm like, you can't sustain this. but I fell victim to, man, this race looks cooler. These, my friends are going here. You know, the community is awesome there. And right. you want to be part of all of these things, which is really amazing and fun. But I think you have to ask yourself, you know, what am I hoping to get out of this? And, you know, what's my long-term approach or what's my long-term goal? And for me, since my long-term goal right now is still to be competitive and, you know, race at a high level, I really need to dial it back. So this year I've done better at that, where with the exception of I did go to the Canary Islands in March and kind of had a death march, an epic death march out there. But that was all for the greater goal of hopefully UTMB in August. You know, I haven't really raced much, or I've raced low-key races. Unlike last year, I was picking these big races to really go after. And just talking to guys, you know, that have been around the sport for a while and picking their brains, you know, a common thread that I hear is, you know, don't do too much. Learn to say no. Although, you know, if I am fortunate enough to maybe have someone want to bring me to a race and pay my entry, you know, it's hard to say no to that because the opportunity could be amazing. But, you know, if my long-term goal is that I want to be around in 5 to 10 years and still competing, then I have to say no. And, but it's not an easy thing to do. So, you know, right now my full training block for the spring was geared up to this race I have next weekend, the Broken Arrow Sky Race up in Squaw Valley. So basically for the last 2 months, I've just been training for that. And I did do a couple of low-key 50Ks in preparation. But and then after that, my only goal is UTMB, which is 3 months later. And I had to say no to a couple other races that I really wanted to do because I fear that overtraining syndrome or ended up like a Jeff Rose or, you know, some of these other guys that have really struggled. You know, I hope to learn from their, you know, training, you know, mishaps or mistakes or, you know, their successes. And, I think it's hard to set up a training block, but, you know, if we looked at it systematically and from a transfer perspective, the body needs recovery. And if that recovery is true, you know, time off, or if it's just down periods of not intense training, you know, each person is individual, but you need that in there. And without it, the risk of overtraining syndrome or a burnout mentally or physically, or adrenal fatigue, these types of things that are, you know, big, scary words and conditions for any endurance athlete, I think you're knocking at that door, you know, and risking it. So, I'm going to do my best moving forward, but it's not going to be easy. I know I'm going to make mistakes.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot of discipline. And that leads to my next question here is, you know, we talk a lot about it's an A race or a B race, and we are allowed to have B races in preparation to our A race. In fact, B races can teach us a lot about nutrition, about pace, about all the things. But how does a guy like you and others like you show up and put on a bib and run a B race and be okay with not being on the podium and then having people come up and say, hey, Tim, I really shouldn't be running this pace with you. You're the fast guy. How come? And just hearing that just blah, 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 you know, how do you do that?
Yeah, you know, I think maybe two ways to do that would be, one, just really be confident in being able to check your ego and not worry about it, and just kind of know what your greater goals are, which I think is all of us progress, you know, from high school to college to post-collegiate, we hopefully are learning to let the ego go because it's, you know, it's kind of a narcissistic thing to really focus on yourself all the time, but it is tough, I think, in the sense that just most of us are conditioned that when the bib goes on, that means it's a race. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to hold yourself back, knowing that maybe that isn't the goal of the day. And for me, I think part of it is right now maybe just not entering these big level races. And maybe if I need a B race, find, you know, a very low-key race and go there, maybe to reduce the temptation. But I think it is a tough thing to answer or hold yourself to.
You know, your teammate Sally McQuarrie was right. She says you're going to have a great time talking to Tim. He's a fun guy, and you know a lot of stuff too. diet. There's a lot of stuff going on where we're talking about fat adapted runners. Now, I would imagine with your background, you may or may not have an opinion on this, and I think you do. Have you adapted your diet in any way?
You know, I wouldn't say I've adapted my daily diet in any way. In a lot of ways, I probably should work on it a little bit more. You know, a dream of mine would be to have a nutritionist that just plans my meals and I can listen to her or him because that's sort of historically been kind of my pitfall is my diet, because I really enjoy food, and I enjoy bad food. I enjoy good food. And, I'm a huge candy and chocolate and donut nerd, which is okay because I run so much I can get away with it, but I know that I'm not always fueling the tank with the most appropriate fuel. But something I have kind of adapted is in training, sort of these depletion runs. That's something I am a bit into and experimenting with, just kind of going into more of that kind of starvation mode, or you know, trying to get into more fat adaptation in the longer run by being depleted or taking nothing. With the, you know, the null or the recognition that there's a big chance of bonking or just feeling horrible on that run, and the recovery is going to be slower. So those are things to consider. But I do try to do that maybe once every month or 6 weeks, maybe sometimes more frequent, but on long runs where I just kind of go out there depleted, or I might only take water and take no fuel. And I think it has, you know, subjectively, I've noticed kind of my ability to maybe at points of a race deal with that, you know, inevitable kind of gut fatigue where I can't take in calories, or you're kind of on the verge of a bonk. But it's something that I do cautiously because I know that there's a high risk of, you know, a lot of problems, you know, with your kidneys or, you know, other systems in your body shutting down because you're pushing past the point that you should be because there's no caloric, you know, intake anymore. I've had some friends that experiment with the high fat, low carb daily diet, and a guy, Matthew Lay, he wrote a really good article and kind of blog on it, that is worth checking out. He does a good recap on it, but I personally haven't experimented too much in that daily stuff yet.
Great.
I was just going to ask about nutrient timing, and it sounds like that's kind of what you talked about here, where you're almost forcing a bonk. But have you ever experimented with nutrient timing when you eat during the day, and how that sets up with your training schedule? And is there a difference? Have you found a better method?
So just like daily eating, you know, I almost all my training is done in the morning. So I'm kind of my go-tos are I wake up, I have coffee and oatmeal and almond butter, and that's kind of my staple. And then I go for my training run. And it's normally I eat anywhere between half hour to 2 hours before I go out for a run. And I've gotten to the point where I don't have any GI distress with that, which is nice. Then throughout the day, you know, I'm working all day long. And if I have an evening run, I do find that I typically do need coffee to get myself out the door for an evening run after, you know, working in the clinic all day. And then I normally won't eat within, you know, I won't have a meal within 2 hours of a evening run, but maybe like some sort of snack half hour before just to kind of get some stuff in my system.
Before we move on to simple rules, I there was a quote that you had on your blog, and it was from, and I don't know, Coach Mike. You had Coach Mike listed there, and so maybe you could share who he is. But the statement that you connected with Coach Mike was, it's better to be 10% undertrained than 1% overtrained. Can you elaborate on that? Because I think that's that's wisdom.
Yeah, so that's definitely something that has stuck with me for a long time, and I think there's so much truth to it. And you know, you guys should probably make bumper stickers or something and start selling those. But it's a message that I think everyone needs to hear. And so Coach Mike, he was a good friend that I met here in Mammoth when I first moved here, and he was Dina Castor's training partner for a number of years, and he paced her to her American record in London. He was an accomplished runner himself, a 2:17 marathoner. And I met up with him here and started training, and he took over my coaching. And I still think he's one of the best, you know, marathon coaches. He trained under Terrence Mahone, who I think is the best marathon coach in the country, who coached Ryan Hall and Dina and many others. But so that was something he told me, and, you know, that was specifically towards marathoning, where, you know, it's better to go into a marathon, you know, slightly undertrained than even 1% overtrained, because if you're burnt out, like even that 1%, you've kind of shot yourself in the foot before the gun goes off. Like, you know that you're not going to be able to squeeze out your potential in the race. And I think a lot of that goes true for ultra running. You know, you'll hear a lot of guys that put in these insane training blocks leading up to Western States, And then maybe they don't have the performance they want. And you ask them, they say, yeah, I left the training on the trails beforehand. You know, and it's because they, you know, they were probably greater than 1% overtrained. But it's kind of a tough environment to navigate, because everyone's going to have a different response to their training, how much they can hold or they can hold up to, what they, you know, how much vert or intensity or volume. So it's going to vary, and it's a learning process, and hopefully you're around long enough to dial in that appropriate level for yourself. But, you know, I think in general, if people go into a race under train, you're already in a better position. You're not going to, you maybe don't hit the all-time best PR you could have if you'd been 99% trained, but that's such a fine line that you ride even with injury risk, that the risk of getting to the start line healthy is even greater. And I think it's better to, you know, kind of look at what the risk-reward ratio is, or the cost, you know, benefit, you know, analysis of, you know, just getting to the start line healthy, which is all we can really ask for.
And I think one of the reasons that many of us end up overtrained and over that line that is not to our advantage, is that we're afraid we're going to lose fitness. We're afraid to rest. And I'm interested in your take on that, of just how long can you rest before things start falling apart? And I know there's all kinds of referenced literature out there that you can start pulling in, but I'm just asking you, in your experience, mm-hmm. in your observations, you know, do you fall apart in 3 hours without doing a workout?
Yeah, I just become a nervous wreck. Lindsay knows to go sleep on the couch. you know, I think that if you can get within 7 to 10 days of an event, you know, with some sort of hard effort, you can ride that fitness all the way into the event and have no problems. You know, maybe it's not your ideal taper and you might feel a little flat, but you're not going to lose all your fitness in that final 7 to 10 days. So personally, if I can get a hard workout within 7 to 10 days of my final event, I know that I'm, unless I'm injured, you know, I can't run without pain, I know that I can still compete well. You know, I would like to even, you know, get another final tune-up workout 7 days out, 5 days out, maybe even 4 days, or not five and four, but let's say 4 days out. I'd like to kind of get the wheels spinning a little bit. But I think that kind of that threshold of 7 to 10 days, if you get within that realm, you're not going to lose everything that you had, you know, in your 3 to 4 month training block beforehand. I think that's kind of a rule that I live by.
Yeah, I think that's good advice, and I think that's one way we can stay away from that overtrained piece, is just to have confidence in the fitness that you've gathered up, and our body doesn't have a big, like you said, energy leaks. It doesn't have a fitness leak that you can't control. We're pretty tight when it comes to that.
Exactly.
Good.
You know, I think that we may have covered some of the simple rules, but I'd like to get into the simple rules of Tim Tollefson.
Let's do just a brief what is a simple rule? And we've talked about it in the past, that it is a complex world we're in especially with trail running and ultra running. There are many decisions that need to be made, and sometimes after a few miles, we're not really qualified to make those decisions. So we need some safe rules, some guardrails, some barriers to allow us, when we're in good space, to really think about what we're going to do, with nutrition, with pace, with heart rate, or whatever we're trying to manage. So
it takes the thinking out of the decision.
We can't have
the rules are there and you don't even think about them. Those are the rules and you follow them.
And you can't rely on an aid station worker.
Right. You can't ask them. Yeah. So for Tim Tollefson, what are some simple rules that you live by in training and racing?
Sure. So, I think for me, just especially with my real life is what I call it, and as a physical therapist and working with people, athletes or community members on a daily basis, you know, I think a lot of my simple rules really are built around staying healthy. And, you know, because if you're not healthy, you can't do what you love. And if that's just hiking with your dog, or if it's running an ultra marathon, I think we have to be healthy. Otherwise, you know, our livelihood or our passion is taken away. So kind of, I was thinking about that, and my three big training or simple rules, I would say, and if I just listed them right off the bat, would be: one, consistency is key. Number two, it's all in the hips. And number three, avoid training fads. Those are kind of my three big rules. And I guess to elaborate on them, number one, consistency is key. Like, in distance running or any endurance sport, there are no shortcuts. There are no just immediate magic bullets that are going to give you that, you know, that next level, with the exception of performance enhancing drugs. Totally different podcast topic. Yeah. But, you know, I think that you really have to invest in the long run. You know, I've been around distance running, I think 18 years now, 17 years. And, you know, it's really about that consistency week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out, and taking the long game. You know, and you have to avoid kind of that yo-yo training where you're in really good shape and then you take a month or two off, or the true weekend warrior mentality where you're super busy for 5 days, but you have 2 days off, so you're just going to, you know, cram everything into the weekend, which, you know, I think can be done in the right sense, but you have to be careful not to overdo things. So I think that, you know, I mean, and I could give out key workouts, you know, that should be done, you know, tempos or hills or strides or whatever it is, but I think the number one thing is to be healthy. And that really comes from consistency. You know, so if you're not consistent, you risk yourself, or you put yourself at risk for being unhealthy or getting injured. And that's really, you know, pun intended, the Achilles heel of the distance runner is, you know, being injured. You know, if you can't make the start line, you're never going to run your goal race. So that's, consistency is key. All on the hip, you know, I laugh with friends, but Happy Gilmore. You know, Chubbs from Happy Gilmore, he was spot on when he said, it's all on the hip. It's all on the hip. And, you know, seriously, as a runner, I think that is the most overly looked area that is underdeveloped. And our sport is a single-leg sport. We never have two legs on the ground. Well, ultra running, I said, we do have two legs on the ground. We walk and we hike. But running in general is a single-leg sport. You know, you have one leg on the ground. And to keep good stability, and as we talked about earlier, to minimize those energy leaks, you need strong hips. And I don't care if you're a 4 foot striker or a heel striker, or, you know, your maximal shoe or a minimal shoe, you need strong hips. It's, you know, clear, you know, all the research is showing that. And, you know, that is a key way to keep everything above and below in the kinetic chain, you know, operating smoothly, minimizing those energy leaks. So I think, you know, every runner should be doing single leg bridges, you know, get a TheraBand, one of those stretchy rubber bands, tie it around, make a loop, do some sidestepping back and forth. Do some kickbacks where you're standing on one foot and kind of kicking back at a diagonal, you know, keeping your upper body real straight and rigid. I think these are key things that you need to do to keep your hips strong, because it's going to keep your body strong. And it really is all in the hips. And then I think,
Hey, Tim, can I pause you there for a second? And I concur with you. I think when you start watching someone that is fatigued and their gait goes to heck, it's their hips. They're swaying to the side. They're leaning forward. I mean, their core is no longer supporting the activity they're doing. And then it becomes, you'll look probably like somebody playing water polo underneath the water. You know, you're just trying to make it happen.
Yeah, it's totally true. You are correct. And you'll see that at the end of any marathon. You'll see it at the end of ultra marathons exponentially. And once the hips go, and then your knees start hurting, and then your feet start hurting, your low back will start hurting, you know, so, and it's something that I find, you know, I'll test clients and runners and patients, and, you know, they might, and it could just be that they're not utilizing their hips, you know, so it's not that you aren't strong, but maybe you're not engaging it properly. So learning how to engage it at the right time in the gait cycle and learning how to make it work for you is important.
Do you think about your hips during the run, about keeping them engaged, and what if they're participating and keeping them strong? And are you conscious about that?
No, I'm not actually thinking about my hips. I will think about my arms, because typically, you know, your arms will drive your legs. So if my arms are breaking down, I fear that my legs will start to break down. But a lot of that comes from the prehab, what I call it, you know, the training beforehand, where that's where I think about the hips more. You know, in my exercises and whatnot, but not actually in the moment of running, I rarely think about it. And, you know, if I'm working with someone and retraining them to run, you know, we'll give them cues, but we make sure not to give them too many cues. You know, you wouldn't want to overload the system, because running should inherently be enjoyable and it should be kind of free flowing. So if you're so mechanical and you're thinking about, oh, what's my hip doing? What's my knee doing? You know, you can overthink it and kind of get, there's a great term, paralysis by analysis.
Yeah.
And you can kind of, you know, paralyze yourself by just overthought. So, you know, I think it, you have to be cautious not to give yourself too many things to think about. But so I guess to answer your question, I don't always, when I'm actually running, think about my head.
Yeah, you don't want to be like a golfer out there thinking about the 17 different things you're supposed to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, I interrupted you as you were on a roll,
oh, no,
so
you're good.
I apologize.
Sorry. I was blowing through those. The last one was training fads. Avoid training fads. these kill me, and I think it kills me because just in my actual professional world, you know, we see this stuff come through all the time. Like, oh, did you see the latest Runner's World article or the Trail Runner Mag article? I'm just like rolling my eyes. Like, what do they say now? You know, and you know, I think it's, you know, I constantly have people bringing in new ideas, you know, on what's better or why they should change things. And I always turn around and I ask them, why? You know, why do you want to do this? What's the reason, or do you have sound justification for trying to change something? You know, do you want, like, is there an actual, you know, kind of, you know, scientific basis for this? Or is there something that's broken? Or, you know, are you having a difficulty with a certain area of your training or your racing? Like, why are you trying to change up what's going on? Or did you just read a Trail Runner article? Or did you just read Born to Run, you know? And it's, you know, I think that it's finding the heart of why they're trying to change something is important, because oftentimes, you know, if you've been operating in a pretty sound kind of, in a sound way for a number of years or weeks, there's no reason to change things up because we want that consistency. You know, when you change things too quickly, you open yourself up for risk of injury. And, you know, over the past decade, we've seen this huge shift from minimal shoes to maximal shoes to 4 foot to heel strike, and everyone has an opinion on it. And I think it's really individualized, and what worked for, you know, this group of chai tea runners or whatever it is, chai running, you know, over at, you know, Maidu Park doesn't necessarily work for everyone, you know, in the group. And I think that, you know, we should really be focused more on what we can do just to improve ourselves with that consistency factor and stay healthy. And if there is something you want to change, then, you know, kind of answer that question. Why do I want to change it? And is it worth the risk? You know, changing the mechanics of a heel strike to a forefoot strike changes the load all throughout the kinetic chain on your Achilles, your plantar fascia, your knees, your shins. You know, so if your body's not adapted and ready to take that new load, you know, then you're opening yourself up for an overuse injury or potential, you know, major kind of sidelining season ending injury. And for what reason? Because heel striking is bad. You know, scientific studies don't necessarily show that heel striking is definitively bad or that 4 foot striking is better. You know, Meb is a heel striker. He heel strikes. So does Dina Castor. You know, you don't have to be a 4 foot striker to be super fast. But, you know, I think, but at the same time, you know, we do sometimes push those boundaries because we think, hey, we need to change it up. We got to get better. But I would almost argue that, you know, maybe we leave those boundaries, those true, you know, boundaries of human performance for the Olympians or the professionals or the staff at known time, the FKTers out there that are really pushing the limits of our sport. You know, and I think we should be happy with just being healthy and getting to the start line, you know, in one piece and building each year or each season. And, you know, we don't necessarily need to reinvent the wheel. You know, I don't know, but that's kind of my third one is avoid those training fads, because it can be huge pitfalls where you think, oh, the latest thing told me I have to forfeit strike. And then before you know it, you have some Achilles tendonitis that takes you out of your race for the season. And then you have to say, was it worth it? You know, why did I had no problem heel striking, so why did I switch it up?
There's really no way that the body can all of a sudden adapt to, you know, 50 to 75 miles a week from heel striking to 4 foot striking. That's a recipe for disaster.
It is. And I mean, it's kind of sad that colleagues and I joke when that Born to Run book came out that it was a PT stimulus package. We got so many referrals on, you know, injuries that, you know, this McDougal character, you know, is advocating just because he was a fantastic storyteller. I loved the book, but it had no scientific basis for what he was claiming. You know, no real sound stuff, you know, objective, you know, CRTs that he was doing. But I think people took it as fact, and that's too often what we do. You know, we take things at face value because someone reported on it, and they, you know, people with these platforms have a lot more responsibility than they take on themselves, you know, that they are a voice of reason, whether they like it or not. And people are going to take that, and that's their livelihood. You know, if you take a runner and you thought that 4 foot striking was the best thing ever, and I should have been in a minimal shoe, and all of a sudden they're injured, you know, that's a shame. And I hate to see that.
Yeah. So Chris McDougal was a plant. I think our computer stuck, so we won't have to fight his attorney, so we'll be all right. It's probably good that didn't get on there. Hey, Tim, yeah. it was It was a lot of fun talking to you. I have so many other bullet points on here. We'll have to do this again sometime. We didn't even get into your amazing CCC event where there was an epic journey for you there. And I'd love to hear that firsthand. Yeah. But Scott, as Scott links everything. He'll link that YouTube clip that shows you coming into the finish line. And it gave me goosebumps. It made me want to just go out there and put on a set of shoes and run because, boy, you looked in the moment. And you looked like you so appreciated and respected what was happening, and I just loved watching that. And I'd love to one day in the future hear about it.
Oh, I appreciate that. That's very kind of you.
Well, it's easy to say. Where can we find more of you and about you if we want to follow you?
Oh, I guess my main social medias are Instagram, Tim Tolson. And then same thing for Twitter. I'm not on there very often, but Tim Collison. And then Strava. Follow me on Strava. You can get some, training tips or maybe some, comedic or kind of comical Strava titles. And then Facebook probably isn't a good place. I actually started shutting down a lot of my Facebook stuff because I want that to be personable. After that CCC race, I realized that somehow I just was accepting everyone. And then I got infiltrated with, requests to like their pages and, all this spam. And I thought, man, Facebook is supposed to be, for my friends and my family. So I don't really do that anymore for many people. But Instagram, Twitter, Strava, those are great places to get a hold of me.
Hey, and I'm with you on that, Tim. I mean, at one point it was safe. And then all of a sudden I push on, I confirm or accept. And then a sunglasses ad comes up on my page. And I'm thinking, at least everybody's going to think I'm just trying to get them to buy sunglasses.
Isn't that annoying?
Yes, that is annoying. Zuckerberg, stop that stuff, would you? I mean, you've got technology over there. Fix that up.
Now, his lawyers are going to sue you.
Oh. Well, I'm wearing a Cocopelli, so I'm fine. That performance-enhancing Cocopelli will save us. Tim Tolofsen, Nike athlete, physical therapist, exercise physiologist, and all-around good guy.
What's the next race for you, Tim?
So next weekend, I'm going to be up in Squaw Valley at Broken Arrow Sky Race. So hopefully I'll see some Sacramento people out there. They have three different disciplines that can be run from a VK to a 26K to a 54K.
That sounds good. And best of luck to you to that and everything that's out in front of you. And we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds great. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you. So go out and run.
Mass.